are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is State of the Arts.
And you are?
Michael Sterling.
And I am?
Paul Strolley.
Questions get harder as we continue, Sterling.
And we'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, Paul, Breakdown Services, for supporting us this year. Breakdown Services is the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit them at BreakdownExpress.com.
Our thanks also go out to PerformingArtsLive.com for their support of our live arts calendar. Performing Arts Live is the most comprehensive online directory of event information for music, theater, and dance events in Southern California. And in a few minutes, we'll be talking to a woman who is passionately and joyfully involved in just about every aspect of show business, from her first love, performing. She's expanded into production, writing, and producing hundreds of hours of top 10 network series. We'll be talking about that, as well as her upcoming live performance. Maxine Lapidus is with us in studio today. Hello, Maxine. How are you?
Why, gracious hello. So nice to be here with you gents.
She's here. She's back. She's bigger than ever, ladies and gentlemen.
Live in Poison.
And later in the hour, Paul, we have an actor who embodies the entrepreneurial spirit and is seeing direct results in his career because of it, sharing his thoughts on pilot season in our continuing series of broadcasts to assist the working actor. Blair Hickey also joins us in the studio.
Blair is here.
Howdy, folks. How are you?
He's here. And I realize that I didn't give applause to either of them,
so I'll give
it to both of them.
There you go.
Thank you.
Is my mother here?
Yeah. She is. She brought friends. She brought friends who, ironically enough, stop applauding at exactly the same time.
Sounds like my mother's here.
We spare no expense here.
Yes, it is.
No.
It is. So how was your week, Michael?
Well, you know, it was very, very busy and a little technically challenged, I suppose you might say, with the computer. You know, Paul, I mean,
just bought a new one.
Yeah, I did. And I'm learning the new Windows, 7 program?
7,000
now. I'm just at 7, so I'm thousands off. But even that's a challenge for me, but, you know, I get by.
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I can pretty much do the email thing, and I can cut and paste, and I can design some graphics.
You can. What color is the sky in your world, Michael?
It's gray is what it is.
You know what I have to look forward to?
What is that?
My father calls me. My father is an old world Italian, and he's very, he is this man, and he is a wonderfully bright man. And then it comes to computers, and he calls me, and he's enthusiastic, which I can't stomp on the dream.
Yeah.
But he's so enthusiastic. He says, Paul, I bought a Macintosh. and he says it with such enthusiasm. What he doesn't know that means is my spring is shot now.
You're done.
Because my spring is... He might as well say, Paul, I want you to teach me Mandarin. Because it will be just that complicated.
Oh my gosh.
He will call me every 15 minutes.
But your brother is a computer
genius. Well, that's just it. My brother is this IT guru. Yeah, worked for Pepsi, worked for all these other companies. And
is local to your...
And he lives a lot closer.
Yeah.
And he has learned to not return the calls.
Oh, well.
So this is what I do now.
There you go.
So, the
difference. Well, you know, Maxine Lapidus, she is also a big techie, aren't you?
Oh, my God.
I saw.
Well, here's the thing, though. I think that the intranets, as we call it, we techies call it the intranets. Here's the problem with email. It used to, email, you know, when it started a few years back, it was social and it was fun and it was uplifting and it was kind of this great thing. Now, people, it's taken a dark, nasty turn, hasn't it? If you don't respond and you don't email somebody back in 5 minutes, they will cut you.
Yeah.
It's gotten crazy.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing is eBay. Here's what happened to me on eBay. I tried to send someone a purse in a box I shipped. I paid. I put it all together. I put peanuts in there. I put packing. I packed the bejesus out of this thing. It got a little vermished on the corner, and I got an 89 rating. Have you ever had an 89 rating on it? You're dead. It's like you're like Elliot Kazan in the 50s. You're blacklisted. I can never buy a pump ever again. They hate my guts. I used to have to work in television for 2 years before someone hated my guts. Now, I've been one button, bam.
And you might as well say, I sell leprosy over the internet.
I'm telling you. Everyone with a computer in the entire world hates my guts.
Is that what the 89 is on your shirt? You have to wear that
around?
All
right. You don't have to rub it.
I was wondering.
The scarlet number.
It's just a horror. P.S. A horror.
A horror.
Or a crystal, which is a crystal nacht. As you know, the Jews would say it's a nachtmare. Really? But a crystal is the biggest nachtmare you could have.
Oh, really?
I'm just saying.
I am so glad that we have a spit screen on that microphone for you.
All right.
Oh, my goodness.
And what about you, Blair? You're like majorly technically proficient. You actually...
The worldwide internets, I think, yes.
The intranets.
The interweb.
The interwebs. Yes. Just the world at my fingertips, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, no, I was sort of forced to. I sort of found a business partner in a tech dork who has dragged me kicking and screaming into this world.
Yeah, but you're very proficient.
I've learned, yeah.
Yeah. Your partner Brian was your business partner Brian. He was the one who was sort of more the geek than you.
This sort of more the geek, yeah. I mean, okay. I sort of.
I don't mean socially because you transcend him there.
Well, thank you. Very much. I appreciate
not
it.
By much.
No. I was the one who kind of had an idea for the acting world and went to him and said, okay, so let's do this on the World Wide Webs and started my big adventure into that world.
Well, on this subject, what about the Facebook?
I'll tell you what the Facebook is. Yeah. Facebook is a guilt-inducing machine. That's what the Facebook is. Yes. I had my college roommate call me like every other day and say, why aren't you on Facebook? Why aren't you on Facebook? Why aren't you on Facebook? I said, God, fine. I signed up literally just so he'd stop calling me.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, every high school kid you went to school with, every college friend, you know, so then, ooh, they send you the friend request.
Right.
I didn't know you were supposed to, I don't know, I signed up because Mark asked me to, and then I just logged off. Yeah. And then, you know, a couple months later, I log in, and there's 137 requests. So basically, for those 137 people, I'm just a big jerk.
Yeah.
I'm just the guy who never got back to them, and it's not my fault.
So now you have an 89 rating.
I do. Yeah. I have 137.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is that there's people that I've established relationships with, the friendships that I've had, but, you know, I have to convince some people, and I'm sure I'm not the only one this is occurring to, but it's like, you know, I wasn't your friend when you were 3 feet from me in homeroom.
Right.
And now that we're 3,000 miles away, what makes you think that that bond has strengthened in some way? You know, and a lot of times you don't really want to know. Like, I have a couple of old high school friends of mine that have really gone over the top in terms of their beliefs and very militant question anyone's beliefs, but when they're really militant and pushy about it, you're just like, you know, I would have been perfectly okay not knowing this.
Yeah, they send out, it's like it used to be in the mail, you'd get a Christmas letter once a year to get these updates from people you didn't want to get updates from, and you'd know about their aunts and their cousins and how many children. Yeah. But now people do this on the internet. They send out a letter. I fell last week and hurt my toe. And I mean, they're sending it to a mass mailing.
Yeah.
Bought a banana this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's cuckoo bananas. It is.
Well, I think that one of the problems with Facebook, I mean, it's great for connecting to people.
It's the Facebook.
Oh, sorry.
It's the Facebook.
You know, I think one of the problems, and people have started to talk about this, it's either yes or no. You're either a friend or you're not.
Right.
I mean, there's no in between. There's no acquaintance on Facebook.
Yeah,
there's
no
somebody that I wouldn't mind waving at if I happen to see him, but I'm going to keep walking. You don't have that choice.
My favorite thing is the really controversial stances, though. I'm anti-cancer.
Yes.
Boy, good for it. I'm pro-McDonald's.
Yes.
You know, just really, you know. Anyway, we should talk about other things. We should actually talk to Maxine.
Yes, we should. And let me give you a proper introduction, Maxine. Our first guest, ladies and gentlemen, uses her talents, business expertise, and most importantly, her sense of humor to reach a mass commercial audience. Past credits include Ellen, Dharma and Greg, Roseanne, Brothers and Sisters, Home Improvement, and we are barely scratching the surface of her accomplishments, including a current pilot that she's working on called Manja.
Manja.
Yes, and being co-produced with the lovely and talented Valerie Bertinelli. But she has a musical side of her life that is stunning. And to give you a little taste of that, Paul?
Sure.
But the traffic here has gotten exponentially worse, hasn't it?
Oh.
I wanted to go about a month ago from my house in Hollywood to the Arclight in Hollywood to see a movie. Should take 6 minutes. Look, I looked it up on MapQuest. My house to the Arclight, 2.9 miles. That's it. 6 minutes. Now, when I moved there in 1991, it did take 6 minutes. But then now, with everybody on their Blackberries and their Schmackberries and their iPods and their Apple Pie, they're doing the bug. You have to, like, pack a meal to survive the Arclight, you know? I'm telling you, I couldn't even get out of, like, a Ralph's parking lot anymore in 6 minutes. 6 minutes is crazy. So we're going to do a little dramatization for you on my evening from hell, trying to get from Mackie's house to the Arclight. I will be playing the role of myself, and Miss Susie Mosher will be portraying 1,400 people. I'm going to the Arclight on Sunset and Vine. Now, I'm sure that I'll be early and I'll have to kill some time. So I'll pop onto the freeway, then chill with a drink, no more than 6 minutes flat. Or so I did think, cause it's 2.9 miles away. Then you tip the valet.
Okay, we're going to pick that up at the end. We're going to let her. We're going to let her
thing there again.
Tease, you're a tease.
Play
tease.
Us off. Blair, no, we have a better thing.
Totally in the groove.
There you go. At the end of the show, we'll let Maxine play us off the air with the rest of that.
Oh, very good.
Very good.
Well, you know, it's Los Angeles is to me still. I've lived here 22 years and I still don't quite get it. You know, I moved out here from New York where it was very cold and wintry. And I got out here at Christmas time, and I turn on the news. I'm not kidding you. We just unpacked boxes, and it was like below zero in New York. And I see this woman who's the newscaster. It was Trisha Toyota at the time. And she had a little jean jacket on, and her hair was just kind of blowing a little tiny bit in the breeze. And she had this panicked expression on her face. And the teaser to the 11 o'clock news was, too cold to shop in Sherman Oaks. Details at 11. And it was like 72 degrees.
Stormwatch in the Southland.
Yes, with the title and the graphics the noise and the music. And it's like, that was like the whole El Nino thing. El Nino for a year. And then there was like one drop of rain. And it's crazy. It's bananas here.
And you can't. And you encounter nothing but contempt when you tell anyone back east. Oh, it's raining, and just like die, die in a fiery plane crash. It's 4 degrees.
Right,
here.
Or they have Al Roker in the eye of the hurricane. Now. It's like, you know, or Anderson Cooper has to be in the middle of the tsunami in Thailand.
Yeah,
because that's more ratings if they actually keel over. I guess.
Exactly. But you always see the low rank. Sadly, you always see like the low ranking field reporter.
Yeah.
And they're holding onto a palm tree and they're perpendicular. To the ground.
It's good TV. It's good TV.
And that's what it's all about. And if anybody knows about good TV, it's you.
Well,
right?
Look at him go. Did you see that segue?
We try to be
smooth. Michael Sterling. He's Michael Sterling.
He is.
But let's start. Before the good TV came a lot of amazing work from Maxine Lapidus as a comedian and as a singer.
Well, thank you.
Which you inherited those skills, if correct me if I'm wrong, from your lovely parents,
My mom was a stand-up in the Catskills in Borscht Belt.
Really?
Yeah. Yep.
Really?
And that was really that was in the 50s. So that was like before even Phyllis Diller. And, you know, it was really unusual. And she was sort of a social director up at the Concord for a little while. And that's where she started to do that. And then she moved back to Pittsburgh, had a couple kids, stayed there, but became sort of the belle of the ball. She was sort of the Mary Tyler Moore of Pittsburgh. She, like, had the hair flip, and she was on the 7 o'clock news then. She did, you know, TV reviews, and she always did shows. And my dad was a musician. So we grew up in this very
Did he play the Catskills, or did he play that area?
No, he played, like, in big bands and stuff around the East Coast.
Okay.
And they met, and they kind of did this, you know, 12-year courtship or something ridiculous. He didn't want to get married, you know. And then my sister and I grew up there, and that's how we both became comedy writers, because it was so in our family to just kind of crack each other up and go there. And so we moved out here in the 80s, and we were really lucky because we worked together for several years and wrote on tons of hit shows, which we were very fortunate. Sally did The Nanny and a million shows like that, and Mad About You while I was doing in the 90s, like the Roseannes and the Home Improvements. And now we came back together to write this pilot that we're doing for TV Land, which is really fun, that Valerie is producing with us.
Awesome.
Can you share anything about it? Is it too early to share anything about it?
Well, it's set in the food world, clearly, because of Manja.
Yeah, right.
And that's about all I can tell you. But if we're big food
channel. I'm a food fan. Yeah. Food is big.
Food is big, and we were watching the Food Channel, you know, forever.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the only problem is that, you know, I just got too fat watching the Food Channel, because that's all you want to do is just sit there. And I had to go on the Chilean miners diet recently, which I just,
what is that?
I lost 20 pounds. I'm not kidding. I did. I swear, since October.
What is the Chilean miners diet?
It's so brilliant, and it's so
easy. You cheat on your spouse first.
No. It's so easy. First of all, you don't bathe for 60 days.
Okay.
And then every morning, you just eat a little tiny teaspoon of tuna fish, and you lock yourself in a closet, and you jog. And basically, between your own stench, the exhaustion from the jogging in place, and then your own breath from the tuna, you just knock yourself out. You're so nauseous. And then you wake up day two.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Bam.
See, that's genius.
Instant.
If only Atkins had thought of that.
The pounds drop off.
Really?
Oh, my. My.
And this is the A material, folks.
What is politically correct, though? Is it Chilean miner's diet?
It is. Well, in my world, it's Chilean miner's diet.
Okay, but wouldn't you have to be eating sea bass in order rather than tuna?
Well, sea bass is too pricey.
Oh, okay.
You go right to the tuna fish.
Okay. Now, I got to ask you something. I'm curious about this because you said your mom, not to go backwards on your story,
but you are.
But I will.
Yeah.
Because that's what I do.
Okay.
Did you ever get to see your mom perform? You said she performed
constantly.
And then...
You can see her, too. She's over at the Village in Sherman Oaks, and she's doing a show every 10 minutes. Anytime you guys want to come.
She's the one in the big coat?
She's always in the big coat. She's a tall lady, like, much like myself. And you just walk in, she'll do 10 minutes. Okay. I'm not kidding. I'd be happy to bring her over here because, quite frankly, I'm exhausted from her chatting at me.
Don't be hysterical.
No, she's actually hilarious. And she looks like Bea Arthur, you know, God bless. I mean, when she was alive.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's tall and gray hair and really funny. Really funny. Yeah, she's a pro. She's still great. She's in her late 80s and she's still doing shows.
Oh, man.
Gotta love that.
So when
I hope that's a good gene pool, right?
Yeah, yes.
When did
the
comedy bug hit you and the music bug hit you? How old were you when you started?
I was probably like around 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I got real tall quick when I was, you know, kid, and I was towering over everybody at 13 at the bar mitzvah parties and the bat mitzvah parties over all the boys. So you had to crack jokes because what else were you going to do? And then I went to drama school at Carnegie Mellon. And I put myself through school doing stand-up.
Right.
So I used to do these dates around town. Dennis Miller, who is from Pittsburgh, saw me one night. And he booked me for, he was doing a local kids show in Pittsburgh before he got famous on Saturday Night Live. And he asked me to come on his show. And then I sort of became a regular with that. And then went to Carnegie and started to go to New York and did Catch and the Improv and all those great clubs in New York. And then came out to Los Angeles and started writing with my sister. So that was sort of while I was still performing. But performing was great because that became the fun thing for me to do rather than the need, you know, because I could really just do it because I was lucky to have a job writing on shows. And also because when I wrote, one of the first people I wrote for was Ellen Burstyn. She had a very short-lived sitcom when I was in New York. And she said to me, you can either be an actress or eat pastry. And I decided to eat pastry. And I thought, I can't
good
be a size
Ellen.
Two, right? So that way I can sit behind a typewriter or, you know, the computer, and I can just, you know, eat pastry and write jokes for other people.
That's
so
funny.
I did that until the Chilean miners died.
Funny that you say that, because I had a conversation with a person who's on a show, a very popular show right now, and I won't name the person or the show, but she said to me, she said, you know, they don't pay me to act. They pay me not to eat.
That's it.
You know, and that's, you know, it's kind of
wow.
spooky.
Yeah.
But she didn't know about the Chilean miners diet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Only share it with those you love. We don't want everyone to be so thin and gorgeous.
So when you got into the writing, was that obviously a natural progression from performing because you were already writing your own material? But did you miss you're performing now? But did you miss it at first, or were you so immersed in the writing that you really didn't miss it so much?
No, you know, I would always go back and forth, which was really fun. When I would get fed up with other people telling me what to do, I would go and. My little room and lock the door and write something funny and that I could just go out and say on stage. And then it also was great for writing because there's nothing like doing stand-up, you know, to directly know if you're on a mark.
Oh, yeah, to hone it,
if you get a laugh, you know it's funny. If you don't get a laugh, it ain't funny.
Right.
So for me, that timing and that skill set really helped me be a producer. And I think it helped me be fluid. But in the last, you know, I usually now do a show once every couple of years just because I get the bug a bit. But we're doing this new show that we hope will turn into a real theatrical endeavor, and I'm doing it at Vitello's, which
and
I'm
Sterling's
with
upstairs.
Well, speaking
yeah.
of that,
yeah,
I'm going to tell people
about.
How they can attend it. She is live. Maxine Lapidus is live at Sterling's upstairs at Vitello's in Studio City with musical direction by American Idol's Michael Orland.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Did I say that right?
You did.
Michael
did.
Orland.
He's
you did.
Great.
And that's Sunday, January 30th, so it's this Sunday.
Yeah, it is, but Paul, the show is completely sold out. It has been for several days.
Really?
And because of that, and due to the overwhelming popular demand that we have received in phone calls.
Not just from my mother.
Yes, not just from your dear mother.
I'd like 72 tickets, please.
Aunt Doris and I will be there.
We'll be in the front.
The remember? Lovely and talented Maxine Lapidus returns to Sterling's upstairs at Vitello's on Sunday, March 6th and Sunday, March 27th.
Oh, two more dates.
Two more
We're
dates.
We're going to do the first and the last Sunday of March.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'm
absolutely.
Totally psyched. And our band kicks ass. Can I say ass?
Yes.
You can say ass.
Can I
it's
say
it,
kicks
you, you can say anything that you want
Swear.
Because it's yeah, it's internet radio. There's no FCC.
Well, they're mofos. Let me
are
just
they?
Tell you that.
Are they?
Are, they blow. They
do
blow.
They?
And they're good on stage, too.
Really?
But,
lady,
hey, hold on.
I'm sorry. Would you say that again, please?
I said they blow and not just on stage. See, all right, set you right up.
Thanks.
But no, there's an 8-piece band, which I think there're going to be more of us on stage than actually in the audience at Vitello's.
Oh, wait a minute, 8 pieces is a record for them, right?
Yeah.
It's a record for our show, actually. Our show, okay. It's my shows, yeah.
Okay. But I'm not kidding. These guys all play with like major people and go out on tour, and I've been lucky enough to kind of work with them over the years.
And you play too.
I play percussion and bongos, but
wow.
In the show I'm just gonna. Do a little bit of bongos.
Just a little bit of bongos.
We've got a serious bongo player playing with us, Fausto really? Cuevas, who is like the shite.
Oh, really?
He's really the big deal. He plays
you can,
on tour.
Oddly enough, the only thing you can say is shite. Just so you know.
Yeah.
So everything is permitted. Now, but shite
ago?
Gets
yeah.
us sued.
Blair, you want to escort her out? Please, yeah. She's
me,
done.
Please. Hold on. Wait a minute. No.
We'll cover it with a sound effect.
And for reservations, ladies and gentlemen, to see Maxine's wonderful performance coming up at Sterling's upstairs at Vitello's, you can simply call 818-754-8700. And you can also get more information about Maxine Lapidus Live on her website, MaxineLapidusLive.com.
MaxineLapidusLive.com.
Yeah.
We just got to make sure that you spell and say that correctly,
yeah,
as opposed to what Maxine was called growing up in school. What was the nickname that you had?
MaxiPad Lapinus.
Which, oh man!
And every derivation therein.
Yeah. Well, how could any derivation get worse than that?
And I still get mail, and my mail comes to Marlene Lafoufis, MaxiPad Lafoufis. Marlene Lapidus. I mean, it's outrageous. But.
The only thing that's tough to remember is that Lapidus has two S's.
It has an I and two S. Lapidus.
Live.com.
Live.com, Maxine.
Okay, Maxine Lapidus with two S's, live.com. So people go there. And you know what we'll do in our arts, in our calendar section on stateoftheartsla.com, we will put a link to this as well.
Oh,
yes.
That would be
swell
again.
Absolutely.
So thanks.
Only
Jeff.
The finest. Only the finest.
You know, Maxine and I met some years back when she did an amazing, wonderful show, live show.
You were a sucker, and I hired you. That's what happened. I got to work with Michael Sterling, which was the greatest fun, and I never forgot how swell you were. And so when I was going to put this new show together, I called and said, what about at your room?
Yeah.
And he was kind enough to say, well, all right.
No, I've been trying to get her to play the club for a couple of years.
Well, okay.
So busy.
We just had a cancellation.
Exactly. Don't tell her that. Oh, we'd love to have.
No, but the show she did then was predicated on something that she very much wanted to bring back to television and still does. And
variety.
Variety. And
yeah.
It was called, the show was
Situation,
called Situation Tragedy.
Yeah. Because
yeah.
It was all of my trials and tribulations of working on, like, for Roseanne and.
Oh, really?
Jeff
it was
Fox
a musical. You know, a musical over her singing. She had an 8-piece band there,
yes.
Too. Yes.
All girls,
women.
All,
oh, yeah.
All hot
it was awesome.
Chicks.
All an 8-piece, all female band. So
yeah.
It was like Some Like It Hot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was our, you know, but we were more of the Madonna, Britney Spears, you know, the hot now instead of in the 30s.
Right.
We actually
right.
wore skirts that were hiked up a little bit. But yeah, but this is just
what kind of show is this?
Yeah.
And it's performing when? When is it? Where is it?
Suddenly it.
Oh.
Yeah, thank you.
There you go.
I'm gonna find a use for every one of these sound files.
Well, and you know, before we finish our conversation with Maxine, there's something important that she's going to contribute to the show in our conversation with you, Blair, and that is pilot season, and who better would know than Maxine about that. So we're looking forward to that. But, Paul, I think we need to do the arts calendar.
And I will kick it off, if that's okay with you. The Ruskin Group Theater proudly presents an adventure based on the legend of 17th century French dramatist and duelist Savinien de Bergerac, now known around the world as Cyrano, a story that I am a personal fan of for obvious reasons. Afflicted with an enormous and bulbous nose, he is convinced that no woman can ever love him and thus makes himself notorious in Paris for his courage, gallantry, and charm of verse. Putting aside his own love for the beautiful Roxanne, he offers his powers of expression to his rival. As this hysterical and stirring adventure begins, Cyrano has been extended through February 26th at the Ruskin Group Theater in Santa Monica.
Traces, a high-energy acrobatic spectacle which blends circus, physical theater, music, and dance, now on stage in Los Angeles. Founded in Montreal by seven seasoned circus performers, this show has charmed audiences around the globe with its urban acrobatics that are at once poetic and explosive, humorous and thoughtful, combining traditional acrobatic forms with street elements such as skateboarding and basketball mixed in with theater and contemporary dance. This French-Canadian spectacle surprises, awes, and delights at every turn, now playing a limited six-week engagement through February 20th at the Ricardo Montalban Theater in Hollywood.
And I think props should be given to Michael Sterling for pulling off seven seasoned circus performers. That was very, very well done.
Seven seasoned.
These people who write these things don't know that they'll ever be said aloud. For more information about the arts in Los Angeles and throughout Southern California, please visit performingartslive.com and, as always, stateofthearts.la.com. So that concludes our arts calendar. And, Michael, you have a review to share with us today about something you saw this... Was it this weekend?
It was Friday, yes.
Yeah.
It was the premiere, the Los Angeles premiere of Ballroom with a Twist. It opened this past Friday, January 21st, at the El Portal Theater in North Hollywood. And believe me, it is nothing less than perfect for those of you who are fans of TV's Dancing with the Stars.
Love that show.
Louis Van Amstel and Niecy Nash from the hit reality series Clean House served as hosts and performers in this much-anticipated production, which has been on a national tour. Also conceived and choreographed by the Emmy Award-winning, Emmy Award-nominated Amstel, a five-time Dancing with the Stars professional, Ballroom successfully mashes the art of ballroom together with contemporary dance performed by an extraordinary ensemble from High School Musical, the movie, Dance Your Ass Off, and Dancing with the Stars dance pros such as Edita Slowinska, Alec Mazo, Jonathan Roberts, and Anna Trubinskaya.
Okay, you're giving him all the hard
work. That's impressive.
And a lot of people, I don't think it's not Dance Your Ass Off, it's Dance Like Shite.
Dance your
arse off like shite.
In addition to those lovely people, Randy Lynn Evans, Jonathan Platero, and Aid Eyabume from the personal favorite dance show of mine, So You Think You Can Dance.
Michael is sweating.
I'm sweating for him.
And as if that's not enough.
Pull all this off. Please go.
That's not enough. Fast American Idol finalists David Hernandez and Gina Glockson provided just the right vocals and song selections to keep transitions between the dance numbers emotionally riveting, actually. Their individual vocal prowess came through loud and clear during their solo spots, thus adding to the swell of intense energy throughout the evening. So if you're looking for a different kind of entertainment, Ballroom with a Twist is it, complete with a feel-good surprise for every member of the audience.
And I'm always up for a swell of intense energy with a feel-good surprise.
Yeah, well, that's another show. But, don't miss Ballroom with a Twist on stage now through February 13th at the El Portal Theater in North Hollywood. For further information and tickets, visit the elportaltheater.com. That's their website, and theater is spelled with an R-E at the end. That's elportaltheater.com, or call the box office at 818-508-4200.
Michael, you're getting the applause. Just for the alliteration.
My mother's still here. God bless.
Just for the alliteration.
Thank you.
Well done.
Hopefully, yes.
Okay, our next guest started his acting career on stage in New York, but for the last 10 years has been living here in L.A., working steadily in television with appearances on Chicago Hope, The Practice, Medium, Heroes, and How I Met Your Mother, to name a few. Along the way, he also co-founded castingabout.com, the definitive marketing website for actors. Please welcome Blair Hickey.
Thank you, Mother. Thank you, Mother, for having us.
And Michael, you pointed out as we started up today that Blair is only our third repeat
guest
that we've had, you know, here.
Wait, there's been two others?
There's been two others.
There's been two others before.
Paul, you said
one with a split personality.
Okay.
Technically, you're
I understand.
Second. But, so how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much for having me back. And I want to apologize. I didn't actually bring my own musical introduction number. I didn't know it was a requirement.
Oh, we have one for you. Would you like it?
I would love it.
Okay, we'll do it again. Please welcome Blair Hickey.
Thank you. Please don't sue us. We don't really.
I'm just going to carry that around and play it every time I walk into a room. I love that.
Yeah.
It'll turn a few heads.
Yeah. I did a movie with Roger Daltrey called what was it called? It was originally called Father Jim was the name of it, and it became renamed Cold Justice. And I was a gay man in a prison who put the moves on him.
Then he made that sound.
And then he made that sound. Yes, as I approached him. But he's a little man, and he played a boxer, but he's short. So, and I'm not. So they actually had him on Alan Ladd boxes. They had him up on little.
I thought you were going to say they had him on Alan Ladd.
They had him. Well, that only made the European cut. But that was some. It was a lot of fun. So now I want to. One of the reasons we want to have you on is because we started this series that we did in the first couple of months with the show, which is to benefit the working actor, and wanted to talk to them about pilot season and all of the. Really, the misinformation that's attached to that. And one of the things we talked about with you before we came in is the myth of pilot season.
Yes, tell us about that myth.
I remember when I was in New York and I started, and every year it would come around this time of year and people say, oh, it's pilot season. You got to go to pilot season. You're going to pilot season? Let's pack up and go to pilot season. And it was a big deal, and I got caught up in it, and I thought, oh, man, I don't have any money. I can't go to pilot season. I'm a loser. I'm at home, and everyone's going to pilot season. I didn't really know what it was.
Ernest Borgnine actually advised you on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had it as a management-type position, you know. I didn't know I could do Ernest Borgnine. That's good to know.
You didn't realize
I gotta put that. Hold on, I'm gonna put that on my resume. Somebody give me a pen.
My agent was a pirate.
So now that I've been out here in LA for about 10 years, it's sort of a different story. I think there are a lot of people around the country who get excited and want to come to LA for pilot season. And first of all, let's just say there's exceptions to every rule. So what I'm about to say is, somebody's going to call and say, well, I came out to L.A. for pilot season. I didn't know anybody, and I booked a show.
Right.
Well, yes, it does happen.
Right.
But if you're talking about what happens most of the time, what you want to do to plan your acting career out for the long-term career, you want to play your strengths, and you want to play towards what's actually going to pay off.
Right.
And if you haven't done a lot of work, if you don't have a lot of guest star credits on your resume, if you don't know a lot of casting directors or even producers, packing up for a couple months, coming out to L.A., getting temporary housing, and just trying to jump in the game because it's pilot season is a really tough road to go.
Right.
It's really hard. And I think that becomes obvious when you start to think about it, not from the acting point of view, but from the other side, from the producer's point of view, from the casting director's point of view. What's actually going on in pilot season? Everybody is trying to create and sell a show. This is the business part of the show business.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go up the chain, first you have casting directors who are trying to impress producers so they can get a job, so they can pick up another show. It's like actors booking a gig, director picks up another pilot. So they'll have a meeting with the producer and go, okay, here's who I envision for the show. Let me give you these names. And, of course, they're talking names. They're talking about people that the producers and the casting directors know from television. Oh, yeah, I saw so-and-so in that three-episode arc they did. Or, yeah, they had their own show a year ago. I know who that is. Then the producers are trying to impress and sell that idea to the studio. Then the studio is going to take that idea and those names and try and sell them to the networks. And then eventually the networks have to take this whole package up front and sell that to the advertisers and say, okay, here's our show, here's the names, here's the people who are going to be in it. So the actors who are getting hired for pilots are assets. They are people who can help sell the show. Mm-hmm. And you got to ask yourself, if you're coming out here and you haven't done a lot of work, are you really that valuable to the show? Is your name going to help sell this show?
At that stage of the process.
At that stage of the process,
right.
Exactly. So, and if you think about it from the point of view of these buyers and sellers, it makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of actors in L.A., and there's a lot of casting directors and producers who have worked with actors over the years. I've got casting directors who I've known for 10 years, and most of the gigs that I book now are people that I already know. They know my work. I know them. They call me in. And I'm doing co-star and guest star work. And just to clarify for folks who may be wondering, every show has the regulars on it, of course. Then the guest stars are the bigger roles. You're in most of the episode. The episode's sort of about you. You know, in the law shows, maybe you're getting sued or you're the guy suing, whatever it is. Then there's co-star roles, which are the smaller one scene. You know, you're the waiter, you're the cop, you're the one line, whatever it may be. So, you know, there's a, and you, obviously you start with the co-star role. So there's a lot of people around the country who are, you know, coming out to LA with not a lot on their resume looking for these pilot auditions. And it's just, it's not going to happen that way because, quite frankly, casting directors want to go for people who've done a lot of guest star work or even had their own show because everybody's scared in this business. Everybody's panicked. Everybody's trying to sell the next thing. So you got to go with what is your best bet, you know, even if you come in and give a great audition and you're unknown. It's a great performance, but that's just one audition. If you're a casting director or a producer and you're putting your name on the line for this new show, do you go with the person who gave one good performance in your room, or do you go with the person that you worked with two or three times before, who did four or five episodes of a show you worked on, and that you can guarantee? You know, it's you go with what's safe.
Right. Okay.
Well, yeah. Maxine, yeah, chime in on this because
I think that's really true because it's very interesting. It used to be about discovering unknown talent. That when I came out first for pilot season, that really was a big part of it. The casting directors were really great if they had somebody in their back pocket that the producers didn't know. But now, because so many more programs on television are reality-based, and there's fewer dramas, and there's fewer comedies, far fewer comedies and dramas on TV, they do want a star to star in that show who's been on TV before. So that starring role is eaten up by somebody who's already been on TV, generally in a big, giant, honking movie, who's going to make the series step up, or... You know, like you're saying, it's so I think that's really, really true. And it's strange because it's literally a 180 shift for actors. But once the pilot is picked up, it's a little bit of a different story. Then you have time to come out and impress a casting director and take some auditions and meet people. And they're more apt to bring you in for a part once the show, they know the show is on, going to be on for 13 episodes or something.
And what you just said, I think, is really important. You have the opportunity to meet somebody.
Right.
Because it really is about relationships. I mean, it, you know, especially you mentioned the reality shows. There are just fewer spots available now on the air for shows. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you are, the town is producing anywhere between, say, 60, 70, 80 pilots. And the amount of pilots that will actually go, you know, these days, I don't even know what it is. It's 10,
maybe. Spread across all the networks.
Wow.
Sure. So you're, think about, from the showrunner's point of view, you're competing with 60, 70 other shows for 10 spots.
Right.
You have to go with the names. You have to populate your show with proven names. And these days, you know, if you're not a television name, then they're pulling in Broadway names or they're pulling in somebody from film. So this kind of idea of, you know, let's pack up and move to L.A. for pilot season can be really disheartening for a lot of actors.
It can be, but you mentioned something that I would like you to expand on, which is the whole idea of building relationships, because we don't want to be all gloom and doom here. We're being realistic, but we're not being gloom and doom. So what tools are available to actors to, because, I mean, Blair, it's obviously working for you. You've had, we had a conversation off the record yesterday. Your last seven auditions, you booked five of them. Mm-hmm. So you're doing something right, and you booked five, and they're all network, you know, guest starring primarily. Yes.
Guest star and co-star. It's been a mix of both. Yeah.
But so if I am coming here, not just for pilot season, but for pilot season and on, what can I do to establish these relationships with casting directors?
And that's a good point. You're right. We did start with the gloom and doom, but let's move on to the good news part of it. One thing to keep in mind is, you know, while pilot season is going on, it should be mentioned that a lot of those name actors who are now auditioning for pilots don't have time to audition for the existing shows or the smaller roles. Somebody who may do a guest star on an existing show has pilots lined up. So
pilot season can benefit you in other ways.
Absolutely. And I've contacted some of the casting directors I know who are casting pilots and existing shows to say, hey, you know, I know you're really busy, but I'm around, you know, and some of those spots may be available for me on existing shows because some of the actors that they want are unavailable because they're working on so many pilots. But again, those are casting directors I know, and building those relationships smartly, as you said, is the goal here.
Right.
So if you're coming out during pilot season or any other time, think, and this is my philosophy, but so far it's seemed to pay off pretty well, is my day job. Every day, my job is to build relationships with casting directors. That's what I do. So, of course, I need my tools. You know, I need my headshot, and I need my resume, mm-hmm. and I need my demo reel and all the materials that we all know we need to have. They need to be in order so I can – but not just so I can go in for an audition, but so that I can get to know people. I also need information. I need to know who's casting what at any given time, who's working on what. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as, you know, in any other business, you have sort of a sales team and a marketing team.
Right.
I think that goes for acting as well. You need both. You need to sell yourself for a particular job. And for that, there's all kinds of tools. I mean, obviously, my agent is submitting me for roles. That's one. I also need to work, to do the work, and I need to submit myself. There are tools like Actors Access. Right. You know, actorsaccess.com. You can sign up, put your headshot resume. It's free. You know, it's up there, and that's a great tool for actors to be able to find me. What's nice is actually Actors Access is tied into the same exact system that my agent is using,
right.
Which is Breakdowns. And so when my agent submits my headshot, my resume, that's material that I've posted through Actors Access.
Right.
So
it's not two databases. It's not...
right, yeah. It's all the same thing. Right. And there are different systems out there and people using different ones. LA Casting is great for the commercial world.
Right.
My commercial agent submits me a lot through that.
Mm-hmm.
But for theatrical stuff, personally, I like Actors Access because I control the information and can submit myself on some roles. And then my agent has the same information, can submit themselves.
And the
on
casting people are looking at these sites?
Yes, they are.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's how they receive the submissions. You know, that's right. How it comes in. Now, that said...
Through Breakdown services. Yes.
Through Breakdowns, yes. Yeah.
But, I mean, they're going to Actors Access, and they're also... And you're saying that's one and the same?
The
casting
the projects that show up on Actors Access are placed there by casting directors. They decide when they advertise for an audition. They decide, uh-huh. Does it go out on Breakdowns to agents, mm-hmm. or does it go out to actors on Actors Access, or does it go both?
But it's the architecture is the same. It's just a matter of if it splits, if it goes to agents or it goes directly
right.
to actors.
Right. That I understand. One thing I want to interject, I want to ask you a question. You said about your reel. You had your reel being one of your tools. And I've noticed recently that a lot of young actors that don't have any credits necessarily on television and film, but they have these fabulous reels. So some company is out there putting them together for them where they're recreating scenes or they're in a wonderful environment like a set or whatever, and it looks like they've actually done a television show.
Well, I would say, though, that a lot of the times, and if you look at Actors Access, you'll see that there's this incredible amount of student film work and, you know, people doing their thesis and all this, and a lot of times those are credits that won't show up on IMDb or something like that. But the quality of the product is very professional and is a great, you know, reel builder.
Right. Well, I certainly acknowledge student films as being a viable commodity, you know, in which to gather one's footage. But my point was, I think there's companies that have been developed now that are actually doing this for the actor. They're creating these reels. Mm-hmm. Am I correct?
Yeah, there are. I haven't used one myself. I know they're out there. I know that people are using their own equipment now, and that's the beauty. You can get an HD flip cam now, and the quality is fantastic. You know, so people are filming themselves, which, you know, you need to be careful and make sure what you're putting up is really good quality stuff. But yeah, people are putting their stuff up, and I guess it should be mentioned too, kind of the era of the old demo reel. You know, you had a 3-minute videotape video cassette.
Right.
That's kind of out the window with the digital world these days. I mean, people still have DVDs they can give, but online, you know, with my profile on Breakdowns and Actors Access, it's broken into clips specifically, individual clips, so that casting directors can look at the clip that is most similar to their own show.
Oh, by style.
By style.
Yeah.
If they're looking at me for a sitcom, they can watch my sitcom stuff, and they don't have to sit through the Ally McBeals or you know, something like that.
All right.
So this is a wonderful mechanism for an actor to get a job.
Actors Access, and also mention casting about too, because you sort of created that with the idea of building relationships. So we should touch on that very briefly.
Yeah. That's the other side of the coin. If you are selling yourself through, you know, Actors Access or Breakdown services, you also need to be marketing yourself at the same time. And I think at Prex that's actually more important because this is where you're building relationships. I started looking for casting directors that I knew. This is when I got dumped by my agent. They cut their client list in half 2 weeks before Christmas, and I was the half that got the boot. Yeah. I went looking for casting directors I knew, and I couldn't find them. They moved around too quickly. And I got obsessed.
Or we're run out of town.
There's that, too.
Yeah.
I got obsessed because, you know, I was sad and bitter about being cut. And I went looking for everybody that I knew, and I was having so much trouble finding them. I said, there's got to be a better way. So I made a lot of phone calls and read a lot of trades and started putting these things down in my own database, which grew and grew and grew. And I sort of became the guy that all my actor friends were calling to say, hey, I met this casting director. I can't find him. Where are they? And I knew, you know, I had my little black and white Palm Pilot. I actually knew where they were. So a friend of mine came to me at acting class and said, look, you have this information and we all want it. Do something with it. And that's where Brian, my business partner, came in. He was he's an internet guru. And
Brian
I said, okay.
Wald. Yeah.
I said, hey, yeah. I got this idea. And castingabout.com was formed, and it grew over the years. And, you know, we had to hire people. I have employees now. We opened an office in New York. It's been a great ride. But what it's taught me along the way is that these relationships are so important. You know, out of the five jobs that I just booked in the last yep. couple months, four of the five are all casting directors who knew me already, that I've already worked for.
Years of established relationships.
Well, Carol Goldwasser, who hired me on this show I did, Make It or Break It, a Disney Channel show, actually a lot of fun. She first saw me in New York in 1995. That's where our relationship and I auditioned for her a couple times in New York and have not seen her since. And I got my agent got this call out of the blue. She had found me looking through, you know, Actors Access and said, oh my God, there's Blair, bring him in. And it was Old Home Week. We said, how you been? And she said, well, look at us. We're both old.
So a mere 15
old,
years
but,
later.
Yeah,
mere
that's, 15 that's years all later. It took. But every one of these shows, and actually the event I just worked on last month was my, and this is, I've been in LA 10 years building these relationships. The event was my first time not auditioning. It was I got the offer. I got the call.
Wow. Yeah.
Are you available? And so, but it has taken 10 years of getting to know people.
Did I sound realistic when I placed that call, when I called you?
And said, did it sound like... See, and I fell for it. I fell for it. So it's like,
Maxine, Blair, I pose this question, really. I mean, it sounds fantastic, and I think that every actor should do exactly what we're talking about today. What happened, though, to the good old casting couch? What happened? That's when you got a job.
I'm waiting for it to come back.
That's when you knew you had the job, right?
I'm legally not allowed to talk about
it. 15 minutes
of your time. Michael, yeah. Not everyone can utilize the tools that you utilize.
Well, I okay? certainly took advantage
my
of it.
My lawyer and my therapist say I'm not allowed to talk about it. I'm sorry.
Okay, we should.
My parole officer says I'm not allowed to talk about it.
We'll trade
I am
notes.
Completely kidding, ladies and gentlemen. Please, no letters about that. I believe in what Mr. Blair Hickey is telling us about it. This is a phenomenal opportunity for actors to be able to put themselves to work and to get jobs, and you're living proof of that.
And yes, and it's always nice to hear the information from someone that it is working for. ActorsAccess.com, one of the services mentioned, and CastingAbout.com, also, you just said, now in New York as well, because we do have listeners out there.
Yes, we do.
And we have to wrap up shortly. We have a couple of minutes left, but one more thing you want to say?
Just real quick, the biggest thing that I've learned, and if this helps anybody out there, is don't worry so much about getting casting directors to know you as you need to get to know casting directors. A lot of the postcards that I send casting directors are things like, hey, I saw you just picked up a new pilot. Congratulations. Best of luck. It's sincere. I mean it. It's somebody I know. They just got a new gig. It goes both ways. Take the time to build the relationships. Let them know that, hey, I'm keeping an eye on you. You keep an eye on me. And somewhere down the road, we'll work together. It's not just about, dear God, I don't know who you are. Just hire me.
Right.
It's about, let's build a relationship and work together. That's how you really prepare for pilot season.
And that's for writers, that's for act, that's for everyone in every business. It's all about relationships and what for you to work successfully and have a continuous career. It really is about getting to know people and being interested in them.
And establishing yourself in their mind as a peer rather than someone with their hat in their hand.
Absolutely.
A business partner.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And
well
said.
And I say, and in good taste and in a good color, send a really comfortable couch to these people as well, right?
You just won't get off the couch, will you? Okay.
Should I be nervous about the couch in the corner over there?
Just sit down. 3 minutes to go, but one of the things we like to do as we wrap up, we always like people to share their nightmare performance story or their nightmare theatrical experience, whether it's on stage or on camera or something. Who has one to kick off? Actually, Maxine.
Blair, I think Blair is
Blair, you have
first
one?
To go. Here.
Okay.
All right. So trauma. When I was in New York, I helped founded a theater company, worked with a couple of years, and then I came out here to L.A., and I'd been around here for about a year, and I went back home for a visit. And the theater company was still going on and was performing a production, and I wanted to go see it. And, I watched first act, and during intermission, they pulled me aside and said, hey, Blair, listen, this will be a lot of fun. The play ends where everybody on stage, you know that guy they've been talking about? Last scene of the play, that guy comes through the door. He actually knocks and comes through the door and doesn't say anything, but comes through the door. It should be you. Follow me. And I said, what do you mean? It should be. Come with me. And so they take me around, backstage. They're like, stand here and here's your cue. Their cue is, I wonder if he'll show up. Okay, when you say that, knock three times, and then you enter. So, oh, and give me your glasses. It's not appropriate. So they yank my glasses off, and I'm standing backstage suddenly, and you know, at first I'm going along with, oh, that'll be fun. And then it dawns on me, holy crap, I'm about to go on. You know, and it's like the actor's nightmare where you haven't read the script or don't know the play. I really didn't know the script. I didn't know the play. So I hear the line, and there's a pause, and, you know, did I hear it? I think I heard it. So I knock three times. I open the door, and walk. I can't see a thing. They took my glasses off. I can't see a thing, and I'm standing on stage, and you have that feeling, you know, the lights are on your face, and they didn't tell the other actors that it was going to be me, first of all, and I hadn't seen most of them for a year. So I walk out, and there's supposed to be this big, tense, dramatic moment, and I walk out, and they all turn to me, and I see the shift in their body language. I can't see their faces because I don't have my glasses on. And I think they told me to just stand there, but now I'm not sure. So the actors look at me. I'm looking in the blurry version of them. The audience is silent. And in my memory, this went on for about a week and a half. You know, I have no idea how long I was out there. And literally, it was the first time that I was actually literally thrust on stage and panicked. But it turned out okay, because as I was supposed to actually just stand there.
And the play did just actually end.
That's how it was supposed to end. It was the ultimate method acting, is what it was.
I would say so.
Oh, literally.
Maxine Lapidus.
This is if we're just about humiliation, I can't think that there's a more humiliating story than this, really. But it wasn't because I was performing. I had gotten a big writing job at Disney, and I was on the lot, and I went to the commissary and got a salad, and it was my first day, and I was walking back to my office, and I passed the animation building, which, you know, if you get a job at Disney and you see the animation building, and it was very idyllic, and it was a beautiful day, and right in front of me were all these people sitting outside having their lunches, and there's this cute little squirrel, kind of like Chip and Dale, and I thought, this is amazing. Here I am at Disney, and look at this little beautiful squirrel. And just then, the squirrel looked at me, and it leapt at me, and it wanted my salad in the plastic. And it, I swear to you, it ran up my leg like rabid squirrel biting, and I'm doing this get the squirrel off me dance. Get the squirrel, get the... And the salad goes everywhere. And like 40 people sitting outside of Disney's howling. And I just went, this is, maybe I'm a Jew and I should go to Warner Brothers.
You were, you were attacked by an animated character.
It was off.
Go. Well. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have at the moment for this particular edition of the show. And be sure to join us next week when we meet Jonathan Roberts and Anna Trebinskaya, longtime stars of Dancing with the Stars and currently on stage in Ballroom with a Twist at the
Can
Old Hotel Theater.
Can I come back to just... see them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks to Blair and Maxine for joining us today. As we sign off, Maxine will continue to advise us on negotiating the rodeo, that is L.A. traffic.
Oh,
we
yeah.
will see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
2.9 miles away, flooring it all away. That's the way we do it in L.A. Ahead up the on-ramp of the 101. And the minute I merge, my hell has begun. There's a 10-car pileup. Some driver went berserk. It's a parking lot now. They call it a sig alert. So I get back on Highland. That should be much sweeter. But the Bible Awards are at the Kodak Theater. Some woman's swearing her ass off because traffic's in a freeze. Oh, my God, you guys. It's Alicia Keys. But it's 2.9 miles.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.